You ready?
This is the Mike Salk Show
on Seattle Sports Station.
Are you ready?
Powered through the Alaska Airlines Studio.
Streaming through the Seattle Sports app and at seattlesports.com.
Are you ready for a good day?
Jerry DePoto will join me coming up here in 30 minutes. Mike Salk Show on Seattle Sports on 710. This hour is brought to you and driven by Wayscar Ford. Michael Bumpus sitting in. Good morning, sir. How are you?
Good morning. I'm doing well. How about yourself?
I'm doing great. I learned a lot about spot, drop, and vision versus matchup zones over the last couple of days, so I'm feeling newly educated.
You get edumacated, huh?
I did, yes. I talked to Clint Hurt yesterday. By the way, like I know you were an offensive guy, but like, you ever meet like a defensive coordinator, somebody like that, where you're like, maybe I should switch sides and like go play defense? Like, those guys will get you much more fired up than any kind of offensive coordinator will.
Yeah, that's true. When I was in college, our offensive coordinators were Rosenbaugh and Mike Levenseller, reserve dudes. Defensively, it was Rob Akey. He's at Central Washington right now. He would get me going. Yeah, if there was anyone who made me go to the dark side, it's Rob Akey.
Well, I really enjoyed Clint Hurd, and he seems to bring a great combination of that sort of defensive coordinator energy with, you know, a really smart dude with some different schemes than they've done the last couple of years. As a wide receiver, Brock just kind of taught us, you know, some of the differences between the spot drop zones that they've been doing and the matchup zone that they'll be kind of shifting to. How does that change your life as a wide receiver?
As a wide receiver, when you get that spot drop vision look, you know what you're seeing. You know you're seeing the zone. You're looking at the defender's body language, their alignment, their depth, how they're reacting to your release off the line of scrimmage. When you get into that zone match, man, they're getting sticky. So their alignment might look like a zone, but then as soon as the ball is snapped, it feels like a man. And that's what they're trying to do to the quarterback, is make him kind of second guess himself. So it goes from having the freedom to kind of manipulate the defender to, okay, now they're trying to manipulate my movements off the line of scrimmage.
What do you do as a wide receiver to combat that?
You just have to attack leverage. You have to, one, you got to watch film and kind of understand, when we line up in this, what exactly are they taking away and how they respond to our combinations. So now as a receiver, off the line of scrimmage, obviously I'm selling go every single time. You've been taught that since you were like 8 years old, right? Always sell the go. But then you're just trying to attack leverage and move them off their spot. So it's route running is route running. It's all about leverage, moving off spots, and just going to make a play.
Yeah, which makes you, you know, if you're going up against a team, are you hoping that they do one or the other?
Man, as a receiver, if you are a true route runner and you think you got it, you want to see this sticky coverage. You want to see that all day.
Right.
Because you feel like, you know, a lot of people think that great route runners, they lose guys in the middle of their route. Great route runners keep guys on their hip, and then at the top of the route, they lose them. Because they're so close to them, they can't really see what they're doing. They have to feel and react to it.
So top of the route, meaning when you make your break?
Exactly, like top of a 5-yard route, maybe a 10-yard route. At the top where you're most violent, that's where you get the most separation. So me personally, I loved when they were sticky because I can move them. But in certain situations, I mean, if I know I'm playing against a cover three defense and I'm running, I'm the number one receiver, I'm running a slant, I got a bubble inside of me, I know that I'm going to flow off of that flat defender or sit in a gap. So there's different advantages for zone versus man.
What did you find most frustrating as a player?
I would say a big aggressive corner, right? A guy who was going to walk up to you and make you work right now. Because when they walk up to the line of scrimmage, all they're trying to do is jack up your timing with your quarterback, right? At some point, I remember, you know, you run like a 3-step slant. If you got a corner who's up in your grill and he's pressing you, you only get to one step. You get to one step and you go, because you have this timer in your head that you have to get to your spot. So, you know, and a big aggressive corner who makes you work from start to finish.
What makes you most frustrated just in general watching sports?
Oh, man, when the simple play isn't executed. You know, when the quarterback doesn't go through his read and he's already premeditated where he wants to go with the football. When a receiver just doesn't look the ball all the way in and he drops the ball and doesn't get possession. Or when the running back misses the gap. You know, it's zone right. Left, but the cutback is there and he misses it and he stays with the zone look.
So it looks so obvious on TV too, right?
It does, right? For us, we see it. What is he doing? I'm like, all right, you put a helmet on, get on ground level, and have 11 dudes trying to take your head off, see what you do.
It's funny you say put a helmet on. I always bring this up, and anyone who's ever played football at a high level always laughs at me. But one of the small things I'm always impressed by is how wide receivers are unaffected, seemingly, by the lack of total vision that is constrained by their helmet.
Yeah, you just get used to it. I mean, the only time I felt uncomfortable was like my first year playing football. Like, this thing is heavy. There's bars everywhere. Like, how you do this? But you know where you're supposed to be. You know where the ball right. is supposed to be. You just get a feel for the game.
How about others? Are there other things in sports in general that just sort of drive you crazy? Like that you're watching TV and you're just like, oh God, that's just a pet peeve. Drives me nuts when I see that.
I can't stand guys who miss free throws. Like, there's no reason for you to be a bad free throw shooter. Big
what
men
about Shaq?
Can shoot now. Well, Shaq's a bit different. I guess his body.
Were you willing
so
to give it a
big.
Give it a? Yeah, you got to give Shaq a pass on that, right?
I give Shaq a pass because every now and then, Mike, he'll go like 20 for 22 from the line. Like, it'd be right. like it'd be crazy. So Shaq gets a pass because he's so big. But the okay. way these guys are built now, like, you have to be able to shoot free throws.
You know what would drive me nuts, and it's now become the game. But like in basketball, the isolation step back three is like, I can't stand it. Just watching a guy walk up the floor and then immediately shoot a long distance three with no ball movement whatsoever. Like, I know this makes me sound like such an old man, and I hate that I sound this way. But in my view, like, you should never shoot a three unless it's off the pass.
I just tweeted something the other day. I was watching Steph Curry last night, and I'm like, his shot selection. Like, varsity basketball at Culver City High School, that wasn't going down. Like, you're going to get benched real quick. But
I would hope.
He's got the green light. Another thing that kills me with the NBA is they travel so much. It's crazy.
Now
they
you sound
not
old.
Call it. I'm like, call the dang travel, man. Call the travel. Yeah, and the step back would have been called a travel back in my day, too.
I think so, too. The travel thing, that sort of changed when the Euro guys came over, though, right? I mean, they brought the Euro step and all of that. And then they've just sort of made it okay now in the NBA.
They're manipulating the rules like crazy.
Yeah.
If you go on TikTok, there's like arguments on what's travel and what's not travel. But if the referee isn't going to let them play, man, they're
going to
take
Well, they've
been
doing that forever, right? I mean, when I was a kid, it was really when like the whole palming thing became like old guys then were like, oh, they're just palming the ball up and down. In my day, that would have been called a palm. And that just went away, and it made the game more fun.
You see your boy Ja Morant? He is the palmer of all palmers,
crazy.
Man.
His ball's wild. Like his hand's underneath the ball.
Yeah, it's crazy.
The game has certainly changed. All right, Bum. Good stuff. As always, we'll talk a little bit more next week. And, thanks. Thanks. Have a good weekend, man.
All right, man. Take care.
All right, there you go. Michael Bumpus does a great job, and enjoyed chatting with him about football, but a little bit of everything else. Bump's just one of those guys who can talk through everything. So we catch up with him on Tuesdays and Thursdays. Jerry DePoto will join me coming up here in 20 minutes. So looking forward to talking to him, kind of where he's at. Haven't had a chance to chat with him since the Kelnick moves were made and you know, some of the other decisions that they've got coming. So looking forward to talking to Jerry. Make sure you're sticking around for that in 20 minutes. First, we'll tell you everything you need to know next. Mike Salk Show on Seattle Sports on 710, seattlesports.com.
Need to know.
15 minutes past every hour with Mike Salk.
Here's what you need to know. Up first.
Yeah, I know it's still only mid-May, but the Mariners seem to keep finding themselves in these situations that certainly feel like must-win games, and yesterday was one of those, right? You dropped the first two in Toronto, needed to find a way to get a win. You had Marco Gonzalez on the mound against a really good pitcher in Kevin Gausman. And guess what? Marco, for the second time in a week, was great. In this case, better than the ace on the other side through six innings of one-run ball. We all know, though, in watching this team, that in and of itself might not have been enough. Thankfully, the bats came alive as well.
Ty France, first pitch, swing on, drive deep to left center field. That thing got carry. It is gone. A two-run rocket by Ty France, and the Mariners have a 4-1 lead. Jumped on the first pitch, a high fastball. Got it into the front row, left center field.
Yeah, he pummeled that one. Home runs for Cal Raleigh and Abraham Toro as well. Mariners win 5-1. I focus on the Ty France one because, remember, he had five home runs really quickly in the first, week or 10 days of the season. And then just kind of dropped off, hasn't hit a home run now in a couple of weeks. So to see him get back into that power stroke, I think is important, and maybe even more so because he wasn't moving very well yesterday. Said that he has a hip issue and says it's no big deal. Generally, I think hip issues are a big deal. So the fact that he was able to crush a home run even after dealing with it, probably a really good sign. The Mariners just kind of hard to predict, right? They beat Scherzer. They beat Gausman. They lose to Kikuchi. They lose to a struggling Barrios. I mean, just kind of all over the map, but good on them. They right now are 500 on the road trip, which I think is kind of a magic number, right? Kind of stick on round 500 when you're on the road, win a couple games when you get back home, and so that when the schedule eases up once you get into next month and then finally the summer, you're at least in position to go on a run rather than taking yourself out early. They'll head to Boston now for the first of four games later this afternoon. The Red Sox have not been very good this year, just 15-22, though coming off a series win in Houston. George Kirby, Rich Hill get it started this afternoon. Kirby, of course, young fireballer, the polar opposite of Rich Hill, one of the oldest pitchers in the game and throws about as slowly as anybody, kind of a right-handed Jamie Moyer type. But we'll get to see the two of them and their contrasting styles later this afternoon.
Here's the second thing you need to know.
Well, it sounds like change is coming to the Pac-12, the league deciding the teams with the top two winning percentages will face each other in the championship game rather than having the two division winners battle. So George Klivkov had a press release that says, our goal is to place our two best teams in the Pac-12 football championship game, which we believe will provide our conference with the best opportunity to optimize college football playoff invitations and ultimately win national championships. And yeah, this fits with the new NIL system that I think is going to be an incredible boon for USC, perhaps for Oregon, and probably not so much for the rest of the conference. Meanwhile, NIL is causing all kinds of chaos. Yesterday, we heard Nick Saban say that it was getting harder because Texas A&M was buying all the players. Well, Jimbo Fisher, who used to work for Saban, of course, at LSU, has called a press conference and is responding. He said so far, and here's just a few of the quotes, it's a shame we have to do this. It's really despicable. Some people think they're God. Go dig into how God did his deal. We build him up to be the czar of football. Go dig into his past. My dad always told me that when people show you who they are, believe them. He's showing you who he is. And apparently when Saban reached out to Fisher, Jimbo decided, I'm not taking your call. He says, quote, we're done. So, yeah. To say that NIL has ratcheted up the intensity, especially in that part of the college football world, would be an understatement.
Here's the third thing you need to know.
Yeah, another blowout last night in the NBA. This time Golden State taking it to Dallas in Game 1. 25-point victory, never really in doubt. Pretty great start, though, to the series, both series, really, in the NHL last night. Ian Cole, game winner in overtime for Carolina, and then an offensive explosion in a really intense rivalry, Calgary and Edmonton. Flames were up 3-0, goalie got pulled. Then they were up 6-2. Oilers come all the way back to tie it at 6. And then the Flames scored the last three goals of the game. They win it 9-6. Hyman with two, Coleman with two, and Matthew Tkachuk topped each of them.
To the Oilers bench, so the extra attacker back on. The net is empty, and it's empty for Tkachuk, who's got the hat trick.
Yeah, hat trick for Matthew Tkachuk. Don't tell his dad, though. Keith unwilling to throw his hat out on the field, or on the ice, rather. Some pretty good video of him being like, no, I'm not throwing that. Forget it. PGA Championship underway, first round action. We've got a bunch of guys tied for the lead at 3-under. Some familiar names, Max Homa, Will Zalatoris, and Rory McIlroy, all at 3-under. So there you go. It's everything you need to know. We do that quarter past every hour here on the Mike Salk Show.
And I am loving the spiciness of this Jimbo Fisher stuff.
Oh, yeah.
I've been reading some of the quotes on Twitter. I watched the end of the press conference he just did. He wanted my favorite quote. There has never been parity when asked. Certain people have just never followed the rules anyway.
Well, that's true.
Then a follow-up. Did Saban break the rules? Jimbo replies, nah, didn't say that. Just made a statement.
It is spicy, and it's interesting. I mean, those two guys obviously, you know, worked together at LSU, where Saban was the head coach and Jimbo Fisher was his offensive coordinator. And, you know, Nick's not always known for treating people all that well, right? We've heard of him called the Nick-tator, and there were stories in Miami that, like, he had his own private elevator and you weren't allowed to look him in the eye and this and that. I've always kind of been a Saban fan. I don't know whether all those stories are real, but I just sort of appreciate the way he goes about his business. I think he's a smart guy, and he wins a whole ton, but certainly once you have to compete against them and just sort of the, you know, with these 3, 4, 5, maybe 10 schools that are all at the top of the college football game, they were already doing everything they could to top their rivals. And this name, image, and likeness stuff has just taken it to a completely new level. I think in some ways the kids are the beneficiary, which is a good thing. Where I think they're probably going to have to make some level of change is you can't have these NIL deals and have, you know, the unlimited transfer every year. Mm-hmm. You're essentially, it's impossible to build a team that way, right?
Yep.
So you have to do something. I don't know exactly what that means, but, you know, maybe you got to limit the way people transfer something. I mean, I don't want to limit the money because I think the kids are finally getting some of it, and I'm happy for them. Instead of all that money going to Nick Saban and to Jimbo Fisher, I'm glad the kids that who are actually the product are getting paid and getting a portion of it.
Or if they, yeah, and not have to tiptoe and be sneaky around it and risk right. rest of their careers for it.
Exactly. I think that's all very good. But how do you build a team realistically when every person could leave every year for more money? Uh-huh. I mean, you can't really build anything that way. So they're going to have to come up with a compromise. Not letting kids transfer at all doesn't seem fair either, especially when coaches often leave. But maybe you got to come up with a way of limiting it to just have it make a little bit more sense. All right. Good conversation. This hour is driven by Wayscar Ford. Jerry DePoto will join me next. Coming off a win yesterday, heading to Boston, wrapping up this road trip here hopefully soon. What has he seen from his team since they got to New York? The big decisions they made a week ago? We'll ask Jerry about all of that and more. Stick around. It's the Mike Salk Show on Seattle Sports on 710 and the Seattle Sports app.
You're listening to the Mike Salk Show,
powered through the Alaska Airlines Studio
on Seattle Sports Station.
I see the Mariners get back into the win column last night. A couple of home runs. Power's been missing a little bit, so it was good to see that come back. Cal Raleigh providing a little bit of oomph with his bat. That's a nice bonus. And then Marco just, you know, what do they say these days? He shoves? Yeah, he absolutely shoved last night. 6 innings of one-run ball and really was pretty dominant, and that's twice now. You've sent Marco up against another pitcher, an opposing pitcher, that comes in highly touted. Obviously, Max Scherzer last week and then Kevin Gausman yesterday, and both times Marco really rose to the occasion. So that's pretty great to see. We'll talk to Jerry DePoto about that coming up here in just a moment or two, our weekly conversation with Jerry. And just, you know, great to see his team kind of bounce back once again last night. You say we've got Jerry? That's good. Let's talk to Jerry.
The Jerry DePoto Show, presented by Seattle Pump and Equipment on Seattle Sports Station.
Good morning, Jerry. How are we doing?
Pretty well this morning, Mike. Pretty well.
Good. Always nice to we're always glad when the Mariners win on Wednesdays so we get a chance to talk to you the next morning. I'm sure it helps your mood day to day based on how the team performs, no?
It's maybe my number one goal of the week is, hey, let's win on Wednesday.
I'm sure. Good. I'm glad you and I feel the same way about all this. When we talked last week, you guys were on the off day. You were talking through some decisions, et cetera, and ended up the next day making a series of moves. Let's focus a little bit on Kelnick because obviously that's kind of the biggest name involved. What ultimately led you to make the decision on Jared?
Well, you know, we've been talking about it for a couple of days, and ideally when you break camp, the goal is to give the players that you chose when you broke, you know, the old, I guess, expression, when you went north. And when you go north from spring training, you want to give guys 30 days and just assess where they are and then gather and talk about the things that you can do as an organization, as a staff, to maybe help the young players especially find themselves. And, you know, with the exception of the finish of last year, you know, what I thought was a very good September for Jared Kelnick, you know, we've seen struggles that are all in the same area. And, you know, some of it's pitch selection. A lot of it is just, you know, easing up and having a little fun playing. He puts a lot of pressure on himself. And, you know, we thought we could help by just alleviating some of that pressure and giving him an opportunity to go play and just let his skills hang out. He is such a good player. He's still, and I've reminded a few people over the last week, you know, Jared's still one of the handful of youngest players in the major leagues. He'll go to Tacoma and play in the PCL, where he's one of the youngest players in the PCL. And, you know, I think too many people too quickly are writing Jared off. This is an opportunity for him to go find himself a little bit and in a little less stressful in an environment to perform. That's all.
What did you guys tell him to work on and kind of focus on while he's down there?
Really, that. Just go have fun playing. And the marching orders, so to speak, were no deeper than that. It's, you know, this is not a mechanical thing. This is not we need to see improvement in X, Y, Z. We just need Jared to go have a little fun playing. Because if he does that and his natural ability plays, that's when we get back to the player that we anticipate that he'll eventually become. And, you know, it's a double-edged sword. We can give him three things to focus on, and that likely starts to ramp up that same intensity again. And then we lose the whole reason for sending him to Tacoma in the first place.
How does he find his way back?
It's going to take time, you know, just go back to the minor leagues. It's going to be a performance-based thing over time, but it might not be the performance that the natural observer, you know, the fan in the stands might pick up on. It's pitch selection. It's what you're swinging at. It's how you go about your business. There is no question, you know, day to day, the work habits that Jared brings to the ballpark every day, and you've heard me say this before, they're awesome. Mm-hmm. He practices harder and more intensely than anybody else can. And I guess to some extent would like to see him, and this is going to sound absurd to say, try a little less hard because that might be, you know, being a little easier in how you go about it might be the way that the real ability starts to shine through. And he's doing all of the ancillary things that, whether it's defense, it's base running, it's the accuracy of his throwing, those things have all been excellent and have improved every step of the way. And what we need to see now is the same type of gains in the batter's box and mostly in his approach and consistency and executing a good at bat. And, you know, the rest of it will all take care of itself.
I love that idea, Jerry, of needing to try a little less hard. Only in baseball would you hear anything like that. Just the challenge of trying to balance, you know, your hard work ethic with a relaxed attitude. Who have you been around that did that best?
Oh, there are a ton of guys, and I've shared this over time with Jared. You know, there are a ton of guys that have had those same, you know, type of I guess behavioral patterns or that same type of intensity that became great players. They just had to learn how to channel it. You know, and I think the one that comes most easily to mind is that's not too dissimilar from what I understand from, you know, where Bryce Harper was when he first came to the big leagues. And I know former teammates of mine that had traits like that, where guys like Jeff Kent was incredibly intense, but a great player. He learned how to channel it. And similarly with a guy like Albert Bell or Eddie Murray, you know, they were just very intense about going about their business. And, you know, for some of those guys, it's natural and they're able to manage it through their lives, like maybe Eddie did. And for others, they need a little bit of time to sort that through, like maybe it was the case for Albert.
Talking to Jerry DePoto, as we do here every week on Seattle Sports on 710. You guys went into New York. You won 2 out of 3. How important was that for the ball club?
You know, I think this road trip as a whole, it was fun to go in and win 2 out of 3 in New York. You know, a team that is really as good as any we faced and was on a roll to the point where they hadn't lost a series all year. And the way we won it, you know, the drama in the end, I could have probably done without, but it was it did help to create, you know, a little bit of momentum, because that's an area where we were struggling. It was just finding some momentum. And, you know, winning the series, finding a way to scratch one out last night against, you know, Kevin Gausman, who's been as good as anybody this year. It is a resilient team. And this, you know, the core of this team has always been resilient. And this is where I think Scott really makes a huge difference, is that he has a great deal of resiliency. And, you know, and he is someone who's learned how to kind of manage and focus his intensity. And this is where you see it show up, is that in these moments, he doesn't get too stressed. He doesn't get too panicked. He just focuses on what he can do to help. And I think you see that bear out. And the fact that we've gone through 6 games in New York, in Toronto, we've managed to pull out of it at 500. as we head into Boston, it's pretty critical for us. You know, this didn't need to be a road trip where we went out and won every game, but it did need to be a road trip where we were able to manage coming back in one piece based on the 2 weeks that led into it. And I think we're delivering on that.
When you acquired Jesse Winker in spring training this year, did you know that he would be such a heel, especially in the Northeast, that he had this relationship with Mets fans and that he would kind of bring that part of? I did not see that coming.
The day that I met Jesse Winker live, you know, I spoke to him on the phone when we acquired him, and then literally later that day, he was so excited to join. He showed up in our clubhouse in the late afternoon, and it was pretty obvious that Jesse had some personality. And, you know, he very quickly, you know, started to become the most attractive speaker in the room during the course of spring training, and lit it up in the spring in terms of personality in the clubhouse and around the facility. So I can't say I'm at all shocked. And having lived through the New York experience, you know, opposing players who perform well against the New York team and have personality become very easily engaged. And there's nothing stoic about Jesse. He's fun. There's a vibrancy to him. And, you know, I heard Ty France in his post game yesterday that referenced him as a big child. And, you know, I don't know if I've determined that yet. But I do know that Jesse has fun. And I think that's an extremely good trait that if you could pass along to the rest of the team on the days where we're in the funk, you know, it has a chance to be a really valuable skill.
Well, if Jesse is fun, is Marco Gonzalez sexy? Because that seems to be the question of the day on this team.
Yeah, sexy to me. You know, sexy to me is going out and pitching the way he has been. If Marco finds a way, and you know, he's done this from the moment he joined the Mariners. He goes out and he just gets his business done. And like anybody else, he's going to have a bad day or he's going to slump for a little while. But the consistency that he's provided us really since the start of the 2018 season has been, it really been a shot in the arm. And there have been times, you know, through there or in there, particularly various stops in 2019, you know, the second half of last year. And hopefully it's what we're seeing right now because it feels that way again. You know, Marco, when we find our way to our lowest point, always seems to have, you know, the ability to pick us up. And it's not always going out there and throwing a, you know, one hit shutout with 15 strikeouts. It's more like what you saw last night, which is grinding through a good lineup and showing that kind of determination or the grit that good teams have. Because that's Marco. He's not going to go out there and light it up like Randy Johnson in the day. You know, he's going to go out there and he's going to wrestle with the other team for 6, 7, 8 innings and give you a chance. And that's exactly what he did last night.
You know, it's funny talking about Marco and then the series with the Mets, and there have been a lot of conversation about guys who have changed their strategic approach to the game, whether it's Paul Sewald and some of the changes you guys had to make when he came here. We heard about it a little bit with Yusei Kikuchi and some of the changes that they're having him make there. It seems like that's becoming a bigger and bigger part of the role of a front office, is helping these guys come up with a strategy for how they want to approach their game.
You know, it's really 30 teams now have some form of this phenomenon or practicing it. And I think it's why you're seeing the growth, the expansion of major league front offices, of coaching staffs. You know, when I got to minor league baseball, we had a manager and we had a pitching coach. There were two coaches and a trainer, you know, and you know, now there are five coaches and there's a trainer and a strength coach, and it's, time has taught us that we can do better. And at the major league level now, I guess on the most extreme end of it, you see a team like, you know, the Giants, who I believe have close to 20 major league coaches. And you know, you can do a lot when your coach player ratio is like that. And like us, so many teams, including the Blue Jays, have a built out or robust analytics department. And when you take the ability to identify and manage data with the communication and application skills of a specialized coach, and have the ability to let that coach spend the majority of his time doing X, and in some cases doing something with a single or a couple of players where his time is just focused on, can I help them do this? Magical things can happen because we're dealing with the most talented baseball players in the world. And when we're able to identify what it is that we can do to help turn that needle, and the player is willing to collaborate in that way. And Paul Sewald is a great example of what that looks like when everything clicks. And I think that's happening around the league, but it's happened especially here for a handful of years now.
So what do you do then when the offense struggles the way it has over the last couple of weeks? What is your job versus Scott's job versus other people's job? How does the whole team kind of come together to work yourself out of something like that?
You know, in this one, it's actually a little bit, it's a tough question to answer, because another thing that baseball has told us or taught us through the years, and I said this to Jesse Winker during the last homestand, you know, baseball has a natural, it's a gravitational pull toward the averages, toward your averages, what you do. And, you know, my dad told me a long time ago, a guy with a 3.5 ERA is probably going to finish somewhere in the neighborhood of a 3.5 ERA. You know, the guy who's a 280 hitter is probably going to finish somewhere in that range. And I find that generally to be true. What we're experiencing right now, you know, especially offensively, our offense has been surprisingly good when compared to the rest of the league. And it's a really tough time right now to play offense. And I think our offense ranks from anywhere from middle of the pack to the top of the charts in certain categories, depending on what you're pulling. We're one of the best teams at getting on base. We make a ton of contact. We're about middle of the pack in just about everything. And in the dominate the zone numbers, we're near the top. We're at the top. And, you know, somehow we've managed to be about a league average power team. Somehow we've managed doing all this while we are struggling to produce runs. And that's where the trick comes in, is we can't change our process. Our process has us roughly ranked in the top 5 or 6 teams in our league in almost every category. The result is that our run production is closer to 11th or 12th. And that's largely attributable to the fact that we're hitting .180 with runners in scoring position. And that's what history tells you is unsustainably low. At some point, we will start to find the ground ball to the right side, the sack fly, or the big hit that scores the run, and then it'll start coming in droves. And it's something that in baseball, like where we started with Jared Kelnick, if you push it too hard, all you're going to do is make it worse. And the best thing you can do is just wait and reassure people we're doing the right thing. You know, the process is good. Keep grinding, because we'll get there. And, you know, in the short term, and I know Scott and the staff have been all over this, in the short term, when you get in those moments, just take a breath, recognize you're in that moment. And sometimes the best thing you can do as a hitter is just spread out in the batter's box and approach it like you have 2 strikes. Just put the ball in play. And again, that's something we've generally done very well. So it's hard to get too down about our process. It is frustrating not to push runs across, but that'll change.
Well, and it strikes me that, you know, when we first talked at the beginning of the year, one of the things you said you liked most about the team was its depth. And obviously that's been challenged here over the last couple of weeks with some of the injuries, et cetera. It strikes me as a particular challenge for someone in your spot where the team is at in their development. How do you add depth without burying guys that you want to get playing time to, but while still having some serviceable players around that can go in and help out in case all of the, you know, the positive suppositions don't work out the way you want them to?
Well, what I've learned in doing the job that I do is that you're always going to wind up exposed somewhere down the line. There is no risk-free roster. It doesn't exist. And, you know, we have a group of young players and, you know, guys like Jared Kelnick, like Cal Raleigh, you know, who, like the young group that has graduated, Abraham Toro, who a year ago, or I guess during the final half of last season, was a key contributor for us. And they've struggled. But we have to provide the opportunity for them to continue to grow and get better. And the trick is finding, and this is a, Jesse Winker is a great example. You know, Jesse Winker has an irrefutably strong track record as an excellent major league hitter in, during his time with the Cincinnati Reds. And why Jesse was such a focused target of ours is because as a left-handed hitter who had a history of punishing right-hand pitching, Jesse could come up, who could play left field. We could slide him to DH. There was some flexibility. Jesse could come in and allow us the ability to create opportunity for Kyle Lewis, you know, when Kyle Lewis is healthy enough to play, that Jesse could allow us to rotate Mitch Haniger into DH when Mitch needed the DH day, that it would allow us to potentially introduce some combination of Jared Kelnick and Julio Rodriguez in the outfield. But if you go out and you sign a big right-handed banger who needs to play every day, that's effectively, you just block the spot. So it's a very small twist or a nuance, but it is, it does affect the way you build your team. And the one thing that you can't plan on is that the two of those players are injured and don't play in most of your games. One of them really struggles and winds up back in AAA, which is the more predictable of those outcomes. And then the depth that you had in AAA, they're all hurt too. So, you know, you go out and do the best that you can to put players in place. And then ultimately, and on May 19th, you wind up waking up and you have Steven Souza playing right field, who has a 3-win season in the major leagues, who has hit 30 homers in our league, who I do think is a representative player in terms of the depth. Unfortunately, we got there much quicker and, you know, by taking a different road than we would like to. But the depth, truly, I don't think the depth is our problem. You just can't plan for, especially what has happened to our outfield. You could argue you could plan for it elsewhere, but stacking up veteran players via free agency and blocking all of your young players from playing time is no way to develop a long-term roster.
You mentioned Kyle Lewis. How is he doing? How close is he?
Hopefully really close. Truth be told, his rehab assignment concludes on Monday. So we'll have some answer as to what we do moving forward by then, whether that is taking a little bit more time and ending the rehab assignment, starting a new one, or it's potentially activating him when we begin our homestand. He's performed very well. Yesterday was his first time playing back-to-back games, which is a really good sign for us. Today and through the weekend, we'll find out how he feels coming back from those back-to-back games. There's no question he's swinging the bat well. It's been a really productive rehab assignment. It's not been as robust as we would like in terms of the number of games he's played, but as long as he's coming out of it feeling good and feels like he can contribute, there's no question he's one of our best offensive players. And to have him would be a real shot in the arm.
Hey, do you have an early sense of what the trade market may look like this year?
Truly no idea. You know, the game that we have played so far, and which is not uncommon this time of year, is communicating with the other teams. It's a lot of what we call back of the roster movement. It's those players who are on option or the players who tend to go up and down through the course of a season. And as you run into roster issues, troubles, frankly, like we did last week, and you saw a flurry of action between us and the Giants. Whether it be getting players in and out of Canada or what we were doing and trying to manage the injuries on the roster, like we had talked about last week, that is primarily what we're doing right now. And through those conversations, you get some sense of what teams are attempting to do. But right now, I'd say there might be two teams that have determined that they are likely to be early sellers, but early sellers don't even start selling until June. So it's a bit of an unknown for us, but you can see the standings start to shape up. Who's at the top? Who's in the middle? Who's at the bottom? And who has the attractive, the attractive targets that player teams might come after? And you know, we're getting a sense for that, but truly can't tell you whether it's going to be an active market or not. Other than it most always is.
Do you have a sense yet of what you'll want? I mean, do you want to be buyer? Do you think you're buyers?
I always approach it like we're buyers. You know, we go in always trying to manage the present and the future, and we'll identify between now and then what our needs are. obviously our performance between now and the end of July is going to tell a large part of that story. But where we reside is that to go into the trade deadline as a seller would mean that we no longer truly believe that the core of this team can go win a championship. And we're not there. We think this is what we intended to create. We have to get healthy players back on the field, hopefully starting with Kyle. We get Mitch back. We start seeing some of our bullpen guys rotate back into the mix. And I feel like we're looking at a different team. And then we can have a better idea. But I love the players on our team. I love the mix. I love the balance in our lineup when we're healthy. And, you know, right now we've not performed to the standards I think that we're capable. We've experienced some unfortunate injuries. Probably makes us much like everybody else in the league. And we're playing through an extremely difficult portion of our schedule while all that's happening. So I'll wait to tap in and answer that question when we get to July. But we're always viewing things as balancing present and future, and far more likely that we figure out how we can build on this team for 2022 and beyond. What you won't see is you won't see us go out and pour out our minor league system to acquire two players that we have with us until the end of 22, believing that we're going to take a mad rush. We see this as a sustainable, long-term project, and we're going to win here for a long time once the water starts to blow.
Jerry, thank you. As always, this time goes too quickly, and I probably have 10, 15 more questions for you, but I will try to hold off till next week, let you enjoy the rest of your day, and we'll talk next Thursday.
Sounds good, Mike.
All right, there you go. There's Jerry DePoto, who joins me every Thursday at 8:30, and truly the time does seem to go quickly. So I want to react to some of that. Plus, I guess we have some sound from a huge war of words going on down south. So we got a lot to get to. We'll do it next. Mike Salk Show here on Seattle Sports on 710 and seattlesports.com.